The Legal Sunday, the historical aspect of the question, Chapter 2. The spirit of persecution could only find expression through a union of church and state. Origin, persistence, and development of the idea of Christ's kingdom among the early Christians, it brought them into conflict with Roman authority, despite the Master's express warnings and commands. The union of the Christian church with the state was consummated under the pagan Constantine, and the first fruits of this great apostasy was the first Sunday law. Sunday, the chief feast day of Mithraism. Whatever the motives which might prompt towards religious persecution, it is evident that they could never find adequate expression in action save through a union of church and state. Social ostracism, the form of conspiracy we now know as the boycott, and personal assaults doubtless attested at times the zeal of one set of people for the conversion of the other. But real, effective persecution could not be carried on save with the state's strong arm. This coupling of the importance of belief with the strange notion that it could be compelled by the application of physical force thus inevitably brought forth its fruit in the attempt, which was begun very early in the history of Christianity and has never yet been abandoned, to effect a union of the Christian church and the state, that is, to set up a kingdom of this world for the Master, in defiance of his will plainly and repeatedly declared. The messianic prophecies of the Jews, however spiritual their inner and true significance, were frequently couched in terms suggestive of earthly exaltation and military glory. And in this spirit, they were all received and understood by those to whom they were addressed. Exceptional phrases here and there, irreconcilable with any reference to material things, were either ignored or misconstrued. The people, in their depression, looked for a prince who would by armed force overthrow their enemies and re-establish their ancient state. It could hardly be otherwise. The masses of the Palestinian Jews never appreciated their wonderful mission as the custodians and trustees of spiritual truth for the benefit of all mankind. They were essentially the most self-contained and least cosmopolitan of peoples. Exclusiveness was the very cornerstone of their polity. To have entered that land and possessed it was to them the demonstration of their favor with Jehovah. As their political power was gradually beaten down, and the prophets proclaimed the coming Redeemer, what could they understand him to be but one who should restore to the chosen people the physical power and external glories of David's reign? The first converts to the Master's teaching, the disciples themselves, were full of this conception. When he spoke of his kingdom, no number of assurances that it was not of this world could eradicate from their minds the fixed impression that, sooner or later, he would set about the establishment of a temporal government in which they would occupy high and lucrative offices. That such was his design was the belief of his enemies and friends alike. Nor need it be doubted that while the first sought to tempt him to his destruction by inducing him to utter treasonable words, some of the second sort stood around, hoping from different motives that the experiment might succeed. Confident that an expression of hostility to Caesar would be immediately followed by the manifestation of a divine power which would destroy Caesar's rule and scatter his forces. The disciples understood at the crucifixion that the time for establishing the new government had not arrived. They realized after the ascension that the occasion was again postponed. But still, the second advent remained associated in their minds with deeds and triumphs like those of Joshua and of Gideon. The first Gentile converts were strongly dominated by the same idea, merely giving it a wider application. The new kingdom was to have for its princes and rulers not Jews only, but the elect of every nation. But they too looked for its establishment by fire and sword. Moreover, they were inclined to accept, as applying to their own day, the assurance that this generation shall not pass away till all things be fulfilled. And they were generally agreed that the return would be on some weekly anniversary of the resurrection, and that it would occur during the hours of darkness, like the other mysterious phenomenon. And so for a long time, the congregations used to meet at sunset every Saturday evening, when the first day of the week began according to Eastern computation, and to remain together till the dawn, prepared to meet him. The union of church and state among the Romans was very complete. But as the Romans had no creed, they were not naturally persecutors. They admitted, nay, adopted into their pantheon the gods of all conquered nations, identifying them usually, but not necessarily, with the figures of their own mythology. So liberal was Romulus in this regard that a learned writer has said that the founder of Rome made his city, so to speak, an asylum for gods as well as men. Monsieur l'Abbé Gravet, Mimer Acadé des Inscriptions, etc., Volume 4, page 101. In view of these facts, the relentless cruelty with which they treated the early Christians has puzzled many historians. The first pagan persecution was that which followed the great fire at Rome in Nero's reign. It has been asserted that Nero set fire to Rome and charged the Christians with being responsible for the great conflagration in order to divert suspicion from himself. There is little or no foundation for this story. But, assuming it to be true, the questions remain: why did he select the Christians for his scapegoats? What had they done which suggested and justified his reliance on the success of such a subterfuge? Why were they, at such an early stage of their history, odio humani generis convicti, believed to be guilty, without evidence, through the hatred they had inspired in the whole human race, as Tacitus vigorously puts it? See Gibbon's Decline and Fall, chapters 15 and 16, also the article Christianity in Encyclopedia Britannica. The unanimity of public opinion in ascribing this disaster to the Christians is remarkable. The extraordinary tortures inflicted by way of reprisal surprised the calmer observers among the Romans themselves. See Tacitus, Annals, 15:44. What was the secret of an animosity so inconsistent with the whole spirit of the Roman civilization and, too, directed against a single sect? An ingenious suggestion, too, made by Dr. David Irving in his Observations on the Study of the Civil Law, is that it began with these nocturnal assemblages just mentioned. To such meetings, the Romans always cherished a deep antipathy. They knew that in many cases they were the nurseries of vice, and not infrequently the agencies of treason. It was the fixed policy of their civil administration to forbid them and to break them up at any cost. To this we may add that the character of the answers given by the Christians who were interrogated as to their purpose in gathering together at such unusual hours were probably calculated to stimulate rather than allay the suspicions of the authorities. Scorning equivocation, proud of their name and expectations, their utterances were bold, if vague, and suggestive often of violent revolution. They met on Saturday nights to await the coming of somebody whom they called a prince and a messiah. He was to come in glory and to reign with his chosen ones. He was to overthrow all principalities and powers and to subdue all things under his feet. Such language as this from men who met at night in secret places might well alarm the representatives of any government. And if the Roman authorities attached a purely physical significance to these statements and regarded the Christians as conspirators who were preserving and strengthening their organization while awaiting a signal from some central power to break out into open revolt, we must bear in mind that, as already observed, the Christians themselves held the same material view of the dispensation they expected. And it was not long before they began to voluntarily preach and prophesy the overthrow of the existing order and the subjugation of all things under the feet of a mighty conqueror who should destroy gods as well as emperors. Consult Milman's History of Christianity, Chapter 7. Extracts are there given from the writings of Christian authors openly predicting the speedy destruction of the Roman government and its replacement by a new and Christian system. It is no wonder that all who were interested in the existing order of things learned to dread and hate a people whose chief delight it was to denounce that order and proclaim its imminent dissolution. Nor should we lose sight here of the spirit of martyrdom which influenced the early Christians so strongly as to make them not only willing, but often anxious for torture and death. There was the crown of immortality, of eternal bliss, always before their eyes. And there was the psychological fact that the surest possible way to convert men to their opinions was to show themselves willing to suffer and die therefore. An ingenious free thinker, Count Volney, has found fault with the psychological fact here mentioned and has pointed out that a man's preference to be tortured to death rather than cease to proclaim that 2 and 2 do make 5 would not afford the slightest evidence that 2 and 2 do make 5. But this is confounding matters of demonstration with matters of faith. Notwithstanding the extremist claims of agnosticism, men of all shades of belief and no belief hold fast to many things which, from their very nature, can never be the subjects of demonstration. And as long as the human mind retains its present constitution as to these things, the masses will be more influenced by the intensity of conviction which they discern in the advocates of a particular doctrine than by any number of cold appeals to their reasoning faculties.
They were firmly and rightly convinced that by their sufferings they were rendering the greatest service that could be rendered to the master's cause, and that their reward was ever waiting to be enjoyed.
Again, the Christian system of settling their differences with each other before tribunals of their own, 3 see 1 Corinthians 6, and avoiding the regular courts, lent color to the idea that they harbored unfriendly feelings toward the established order, and marked them as men indifferent to the ordinary obligations of allegiance. And there was yet another factor which doubtless played its full part in provoking the hostility of the civil power. The various forms of paganism could exist side by side, but Christianity, with its proselyting spirit, made warfare on them all. The priests of every cult found their credit and livings in danger. The union of religion and the state gave them opportunity, the common peril supplied the motive, to urge on a destructive warfare against this new, strange enemy. While laymen, who found themselves unable to accept the Christian doctrine, were not propitiated by the warnings of their future fate, often no doubt administered by members of their own households, whose authority to pronounce on such a matter for them they were very far from recognizing. But whatever the early Christians anticipated that they would at some time or other be called upon to do, however far they were prepared to go on the eventful day when the Master should come again in glory and place himself at their head, not one of them dreamed of committing an overt act till his command should be given. It was for him to come and say in what manner and by what means his kingdom should be made one of this world. His faithful soldiers were ready to obey his orders as soon as given. Without orders, good soldiers do not move. Meantime, their duty, as they understood it, was to preach his name to others, to maintain their weekly meetings, and to organize in order to work more effectively in his cause. In this way, for many years, the Master's words were fulfilled. The ruler whose kingdom was not of this world was, by soft persuasion, by sweet reasonableness, above all by the example of pure and gentle lives, drawing all men unto him. But the weakness of human nature could not be content with this spiritual conquest. Just as the first disciples mused mistakenly on the time when they should be clothed in purple and fine linen and fare sumptuously every day and be the founders of a new race of nobility, so likewise many of their successors forever hankered after the flesh pots of Egypt. Especially did bishops and presbyters, having the authority, yearn for the pomp and circumstance of the pagan priests. Administering to poor congregations with precarious salaries, they envied the richly compensated servitors of the temples, with their contributions from the state treasury, supplemented by the costly gifts of hundreds who would affiliate with any communion that might be used as a means of social or political advancement. The idea of establishing the Master's kingdom in this world, then, would not down. But the early principle that its establishment must await his personal direction and control was altogether lost sight of. Men began to ponder the establishment of such a kingdom without the presence of the sovereign, its ordained ruler. It was to be made ready for him against his coming, and till he should come, it was to be governed by its founders in his name. And they were to enjoy by means of its establishment such good things of earth as luxury without labor, and wealth, power, honor, and preeminence over their fellow creatures. There came a time
when forces set in motion by the Master had subdued such numbers that it was possible to bring into play forces which he had expressly repudiated. In other words, when so many had been peacefully brought to acknowledge him, that force could safely be invoked to extort that acknowledgement from others. In other words, again, when Christianity had a following sufficient to command recognition as the religion of the state. As a matter of course, the instant that this was accomplished, it ceased to be the religion of the Master. The kingdom of this world was indeed established in his name, but it was established without the king.
And who was taken as his substitute? The pagan Constantine, a man of consummate genius and absolute insincerity, of no belief but unbounded hypocrisy, of no honor yet of effeminate sensitiveness, without a conscience and without a God. The setting up of a kingdom of this world in the Master's name was not merely an unchristian, it was an anti-Christian act. It was done in very defiance of his express command. It was a linking of the spiritual with the material, a degradation of the divine institution which he had founded, a dragging of sacred things in the dust. It was preeminently fitting that such a man as Constantine should be the vicegerent of such a kingdom. There is hardly an attribute we can imagine as pertaining to the complete character of Antichrist which was not developed in him to the fullest extent. He was therefore a most appropriate head of the great apostasy and anti-Christian movement for a union of church and state, the very creature to do in the Master's name what he had forbidden to be done. That custom of the early Christians to meet at the beginning of Sunday, which exposed them to Roman suspicion and hostility, developed into a permanent and important part of their communal religious life. It was natural that those thus assembled should eat and drink together. And, when we consider the object of their assembling, that their meals should partake more or less of the character of a religious ceremony was no less inevitable. But there is no evidence that at first the notion of transferring the sabbatical observance to Sunday was at all entertained. On the contrary, all the evidence, as well as the lack of evidence, points to the conclusion that no idea of peculiar sanctity was attached to the first day of the week by these original Christians, and that after the hour had passed when the expected event was looked for to occur, they betook themselves to their homes and went about their work or business as usual. Yet, no doubt these Sunday meetings helped to smooth the way for the final substitution of Sunday for the Sabbath, to which another motive now to be mentioned also contributed.
Besides their nocturnal assemblies, another considerable cause of Christian unpopularity was the Hebraic origin of the religion. Among the people subdued by the Roman arms, the Jews were conspicuous for the vigor and tenacity of their resistance. A corresponding hostility was excited in the minds of the conquerors, which Jewish exclusiveness and want of deference to Roman arrogance did not tend to diminish. The Romans, in their judgment, visited the sins of the Jews upon the Christians. And as Christianity spread among the Gentiles, this identification of the two appears to have been felt as an obstacle to its progress, and accounts for the gradual substitution of Sunday services for the Saturday night vigils, the total abandonment of the scriptural Sabbath, and the readiness of the Christians to adopt the sacred day of the sun worshippers as their own. Some of the early Christian writers, indeed, betray a disposition to represent Christianity as a refined, spiritualized, sublimated version of the religion of Mithra. It is curious to find these men, for the sake of popularity and in order to commend their cause to the minds of others, willing to be confused with sun worshippers in the minds of the superficial, while strenuously endeavoring, as witness the frequent decrees of councils against Judaizing by the observance of the Sabbath, to emphasize the completeness of their separation from that race to which their founder belonged, and whose Sabbath was the only one he knew.
It has been observed that the anti-Christian movement toward a union of church and state was the result of the unchristian lust of the clergy after wealth and honor. Of course, as soon as that union was effected, they began to use it for their own worldly aggrandizement.
Now the collection box is, so to speak, the center or cogwheel of the machinery for clerical aggrandizement. But in order that people may put their money in the collection box, they must first go to church. It was perceived that to force them to go to church would be a difficult and costly experiment of police. Yet something might obviously be accomplished by calling them off from their regular occupations. The enforced idleness would naturally lead to contemplation, and contemplation might suggest that one way of killing the time was to go to church. Moreover, the Jews had set the fashion for all time of the observance of a weekly sacred day. True, with the Jews there was no such indirect purpose of driving people to church and into the presence of the collection box, on which last their clergy were not dependent. The Hebrew Sabbath was quite as much a day of rest for priests as for the people generally. It was set apart with no such sinister purpose as Sunday has been set apart, but in plain good faith that all might pause in the race of life to ponder the mystery of a creative and protective deity. But it seems that this spiritual purpose of the Sabbath, while it is distinctly set forth in one of the versions of the Fourth Commandment, was little regarded by the Jews, and that the national and historical aspect of the anniversary, which concerned them particularly, gave it its chief importance in their eyes. When the union of church and state was accomplished under Constantine, almost its first fruit was the First Sunday Law, AD 321. This commanded that judges and people of the cities and artificers should rest, but specially provided that agricultural labor might be prosecuted as on other days, lest by neglect of opportunity the bounty granted by divine foresight be lost. The name given to the day in this famous edict is remarkable and sheds a flood of light on the character of him who promulgated it and of those who asked him for it. The day is called the Venerable Day of the Sun. A new, exalted, and transcendental type of the ancient sun worship contended with Christianity during 300 years for the mastery of the European mind. Constantine had no religion, but he was, like many other men of powerful minds, deeply tinctured with superstition. And of the superstition of sun worship, or Mithraism, as of every other superstition of his day, he had imbibed a goodly share. Moreover, he was subtle and politic in a high degree, and it was his practice to play one of the contending parties, Christian and pagan, against the other, and thus preserve a peaceful balance of forces in his empire. Now, the Venerable Day of the Sun was the great sacred day of the Mithraists, and to set it apart under the name by which they knew and observed it, to bestow this especial state recognition on their holy day, could not but be accepted by them as a great compliment to their religion and as an official acknowledgement, if not of its sole verity, at least of its superiority to all rival cults. The use of this phrase, then, was characteristic of the wily Constantine. But what shall we say of those who, for the honor of the master, would stoop to such hypocrisy? What of those who were willing to have the day they professed to know as the day of the Lord honored through their instrumentality as the Venerable Day of the Sun? What of those who dressed Christ in the robes of Mithra? Shall they not one day stand with those who robed him in purple and put on him a crown of thorns and spat in his face? The brutal pagan Constantine granted religious toleration to his Christian subjects soon after his alleged conversion. And later, he gave them the First Sunday Law, as stated in the text, in the name of Mithra. Says Mr. Millman, "The rescript commanding the celebration of the Christian Sabbath bears no allusion to its peculiar sanctity as a Christian institution. It is the day of the sun which is to be observed by the general veneration." The believer in the new paganism, of which the solar worship was the characteristic, might acquiesce without scruple in the sanctity of the first day of the week. History of Christianity, Book 3, Chapter 1. Concerning another incident which marked the great apostasy of the union of the Christian Church with the pagan state, Mr. Millman speaks as follows. Constantine immediately commanded the famous labarum to be made, the labarum which for a long time was borne at the head of the imperial armies and venerated as a sacred relic at Constantinople. The shaft of this celebrated standard was cased with gold, Above the transverse beam which formed the cross was wrought in a golden crown the monogram, or rather the device of two letters which signified the name of Christ. And so, for the first time, the meek and peaceful Jesus became a god of battle, and the cross, the holy sign of Christian redemption, a banner of bloody strife. In the paragraph following this description of the labrum, Mr. Milman observes of Constantine's alleged conversion to Christianity. The irreconcilable incongruity between the symbol of universal peace and the horrors of war, in my judgment, is conclusive. However they shall be finally judged, in their indifference to the means whereby their ends might be attained, in their willingness, nay eagerness, to adopt any subterfuge, to avail themselves of any false pretense, to crawl and wriggle to their goal through any byway, however dark and foul, the advocates of this first Sunday law are in no whit distinguished from those who prate today of a secular Sunday and police regulations and sanitary legislation in order to force a dogma of their religion down the throats of free Americans. Recently, Mrs. Josephine C. Batem, who, on behalf of the Sunday Law Combination in the United States, was asking Congress to incorporate the dogma of Sunday idleness into a federal statute, remarked that the phraseology of her measure would better be altered in one place, in order that it may not have the appearance of against the miraculous or supernatural character of the transaction. And in a footnote to this paragraph, he adds, "I was agreeably surprised to find that Mosheim concurred in these sentiments, for which I will readily encounter the charge of Quakerism." Yet Mr. Milman in the next breath speaks of the admission of Christianity not merely as a controlling power and the most effective auxiliary of civil government, an office not unbecoming its divine origin. Of course, there is a confusion of ideas here. A controlling power cannot, strictly speaking, be auxiliary to any other power. But what Mr. Milman means is, in plain English, that a bargain whereby, on the one hand, the civil government was to force the people into external deference to certain dogmas and compliance with certain ceremonial observances, as the same might be settled by councils from time to time, and, on the other hand, the church was to frighten the people by threats of everlasting fire and brimstone into doing anything that the civil government might order, that such a bargain as that was not unbecoming the divine origin of the Christian religion. On this point, one need not apologize for preferring the authority of the founder of Christianity to that of Dean Milman. But these last quotations have been introduced here mainly to show the extraordinary influence of the zeitgeist, or time spirit, on character or abilities of very high order, cultivated to the utmost. On such a character, if Dean Milman discerned the truth of the matter, yet lacked the manliness to write it down. On such abilities, if Dean Milman did not see that the great blasphemy of making the master's religion a controlling power and effective auxiliary of civil government necessarily included the lesser blasphemy of converting the meek and peaceful Jesus into a god of battle, since battles are liable at any moment to become the business of civil government and therefore the business of any power, whether controlling or auxiliary to such a government. If he did not see that a church united with the state must respond to the call to bless the banners that symbolize death and give thanks for massacres and devastation, since this is part of the very business she is admitted as a department of the government to do. If he did not see, in short, that repeating rifles and Gatling guns are quite appropriate weapons in the hands of that Christianity which finds the wielding of the policeman's club an office not unbecoming its divine origin. What all Americans object to, a union of church and state. The idea was to accomplish the reality and to delude all Americans by the false appearance. So the anti-Christian conspirators with the unworthy Constantine doubtless observed to him and to each other. Let us call it the Venerable Day of the Sun, that it may not have the appearance of what all these pagans would object to, a union of the Christian Church with the state. After Constantine's edict, till the rise of Brownism, Sunday, while it was generally observed, lost some of its prominence through the adoption of many other feasts, as well as many fast days by the Church. and such observance as was given it was unquestionably more like that of Catholic countries today than like the present American practice. At different times, however, decrees of council, etc., were passed, referring to the observance of Sunday. These will be found, together with acts of Parliament, state laws, etc., in Sunday, Legal Aspects of the First Day of the Week.